Session number 11448, Rule 4.
Mr. Tanner, Rule 4.
Now, he should have come on my left-hand side. The object of that is that when the magazine is emptied, you're in the position with your right hand to knock the empty magazine on and put the full one back on again. But unfortunately, or fortunately for me, and unfortunately for Nobby, he came on the right-hand side. He was already there. Anyway, I fired away then, and I heard this moan, because he got one through the neck and through the shoulder. Now, where that went through his neck and shoulder, my head was. And I still, to this day, say that man saved my life for doing the wrong thing. And that is why I named my eldest son after him. Well, eventually, Tiger Reed, our company commander, gave the order. Everybody with bayonets, fix them. Now, that means one thing. You're going to do a charge. And it's not a nice thing. Believe me, it ain't. No British soldier, whatever rank he is, likes to do a battalion, company or platoon charge. It means one thing, standing upright, holding that rifle in front of you, your bayonet, and charging and hoping you're going to get away with it. All right, I picked up my Sten. I was lucky having the Sten gun. And then the order come. 2-inch mortars, collect all the smoke bombs they had. Put that smoke down as best as they could, and they made a good job of that. Thank God they did. Well, then came the order to charge. Now, I'm going to tell you this. I claim two things. Either the longest long jump in the world of 200 yards, or I covered the fastest 200 yards that anybody will ever cover in this world today. I mean that, because I've never run so fast in my life. And as I'm running, I'm saying to myself, it's got to be the next, it's got to be the next, it's got to be the next thing. And every step I took, I thought, that bullet, it's got to be a bullet. This is all that's going through your mind. They're going to get you, they're going to get you. We made it. Who's in front of us in the big ditch? Colonel Pinecoffin and the second in command, Major Taylor. They were fortunate, they made the ditch. Now, my platoon sergeant, Sergeant Keeley, he said to me, right, Santana, take them into those house and clear it. Well, as we got to get up, he said, I'll come with you. So he led us in. We got to the side of the house. And when everybody was tucked in safely, he said, right, round this side. And as he went round, this German's come out the door, turned on him, but he got the shot in first. That man died where he stood. Well, then, the next job we got, which was, I had the order to do, was room clearing. It's not a very nice thing to do, really, because the only way you can clear rooms, open that door, throw in a grenade, or a couple of grenades, whatever you can, shut the door, wait for the explosion, open the doors, anybody's alive, just shoot. Again, it comes back to one thing, survival, you or them. Now, after we've done the dirty, if you like to call it. After we'd done that, we checked all the rooms. Now, the dead that was in the rooms, I can't say whether we caused their deaths or whether they might have been killed with all the stuff that was being fired at the house, plus the wood, you see. But none of them got out of it alive. There was about 23, I think somebody said, 23, 25. It was an odd number, anyway. And so, eventually, we got ourselves sorted out. We had to have assistance from the rest of the battalion. They had to come up and give us a hand out. We even had artillery support as well. That's the fix we got ourselves in.
So you'd done the bayonet charge across the airfield.
Uh-huh.
But you hadn't bayoneted anybody.
No, no.
And then you'd gone into these houses.
Gone into the house.
At the other side of the airfield.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were part of the airfield complex, were they?
Well, there must have been some of the staff. It's all to do with the airfield. The house is still there. I've seen it. We went there 2 years ago. We've seen the house, seen the road, seen the woods. Uncanny going back, you know, looking at it, mind you. But
what's the name of the airfield again?
Wunstaff. Wunstaff. It's a magnificent place. Now, mind you, it's been enlarged and quite a massive size airfield now. It comes under NATO.
How many casualties did your unit have?
We lost, what was it, there was four dead, I think it was about half a dozen to about eight or nine badly wounded. But when it was all finished, we heard that Jameson, Private Jameson, a Scots lad, was killed, Royal Army Medical Corps. And again, he was a marvellous man, really was. And his brother was in the same unit, same company, with him as well. Now, the story I'm about to tell you doesn't belittle these two chaps at all. They were conscientious objectors. Now, a conscientious objector, I don't know if anybody realised it, they don't want to fight. But these two lads said they were prepared to save lives, but they wasn't going to take lives. They both jumped into Normandy. Now, each medical man is given a revolver. Nothing more. The object of the revolver is for the protection of the wounded. That's what I was given to understand. They never took anything with them. Their answer to that was, if the wounded need protection, we'll protect them ourselves. Now, as you must realise, a bullet's got no respect for a Red Cross. It turns out the word medic's been called out. George has got up, and that was it. So you can just imagine the mood of us. The prisoners that were taken, bearing in mind we were told they're supposed to have wooden legs and they were old boys and God knows. No, I never see a wooden leg amongst them. What I did see was two men in black uniforms with their SS badges. Two arrogant bastards. I've got to say this because that's what they were. And the mood of the chaps was, kill them. But Ernie, his brother, said no way. He wouldn't allow us to touch them. He wouldn't allow us to do anything to them. His argument was this. Was the price of war. They were doing a job the same as we were doing the job. They were fighting for what they believed in. We were doing the same.
Did they realise that you wanted to kill them?
Oh, they knew. They knew what we were going to do. When you see the blokes all cock the rifles and the stands and point to them, they knew what was going to happen. Make no mistake about that. But he stepped forward and he said, no, he wouldn't have it. He wouldn't wear it. Just would not accept it at all. That's not the thing to do. And this is why these two lads was always thought so wonderful by the boys of the 7th Battalion. They were two wonderful chaps. I don't know where Ernie is now. He probably still lives up in Scotland, or he might have gone out abroad somewhere, sort of style. But well, then, the road to Neustadt, Jerry had blown it. So we couldn't get no vehicles through. It was about 8 miles away. Couldn't get a vehicle through it at all. He'd blown the whole width of it. A crater, somebody said the crater was about 5 or 6 foot deep. So it was a question, we had to do a diversion through woods, over obstacles, through swampy ground, through small little rivers. And by God, it was heartbreaking, it was backbreaking, but we did it. With Tiger leading all the way. Our biggest obstacle was a fence, very, very thick wiring fence. Anyway, that was eventually cut. We all got through. It turned out we came onto a playground, school playground. And away we got ourselves sorted out, consolidated, through the town we went. And as you know, all army units march with one section one side of the road, one section on the other side, in a staggered formation. The object of that is to stop, if you're all together, somebody fires at you, you've got more casualties. Now attached to one of the sections, unbeknown to us, are two German soldiers. Now, the only thing, it was the only thing we came up with, or the only solution, our helmets looked like theirs, in the dark. But they didn't survive. When the last two in the section realised it, they dispatched them.
So they just tried to infiltrate you?
Well, we can't say whether they were infiltrating, or whether they realised, or whether they thought, you know, the German troops attached themselves, you know, on the retreat sort of stuff. Nobody seemed, you know, we just couldn't get to the bottom of it. Unfortunately, they were both killed, you see. They were quietly dispatched with the knives. But it put everybody on their toes again, sort of style. And then out of this big building, I've got a friend lives up in Cumberland. He thinks the same thing. Two things. Either there had been a meeting of these civilians, it was a cinema, they'd been seeing a film, or that was the only place they went to, you know, expecting this trouble. Anyway, they dispersed. We carried on, we found a bridge. Well, my platoon, or Lofty's platoon as it should be called, 6th platoon, we were kept in reserve, and 4 and 5 platoon were moved up. When then Geordie Dodds, who was a sniper in one of the sections, 4th platoon, he'd gone forward, and he discovered another bridge. Now, we was told there was only the one bridge. Although we should have thought better, because it's only a small bridge anyway. Because he discovered this other bridge, it's quite a fair-sized bit, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 spans on it, so I'll give you some idea the width of the river. Because straight away, Tiger Reed sent 4 and 5 platoon across. Now, bearing in mind that Mr. Himmon, my platoon officer, we thought was dead, killed on the airfield. Mr. Pape was killed, another platoon officer. He was a Canadian, actually. He joined us for liaison work. And somehow or other, he managed to get a jump in until he got 8, claimed he qualified as a paratrooper, and we kept him. The only thing was the Canadians wouldn't let him be buried with our lads. He's now buried in the Canadian cemetery in Holland. Anyhow, Captain Woodman had taken Mr. Pape's place, Lieutenant Gush had got his crowd, and Major Reed had taken over 6th platoon. And of course, as they've gone across this bridge, and as they've gone across, somebody said they were aerial torpedoes, some said they looked like bombs, but whatever it was, they was there. He spotted them, urged the lads to, you know, to move quicker, and the bridge went up. Now, I was on the side, this side of the bridge with a couple of my chaps. The others were on the other side, the small bridge. We got blown off our feet. But it still didn't register the fact that the bridge had gone up. To be quite honest with you, and the other lads thought, he'd fired like an 88 or something like that, and it was a shell that had exploded, but we didn't hear it. Of course, then we heard these cries. Oh, Christ, when we got to the bridge and realised what happened, because there's debris falling and everything, you couldn't believe it. There's 2 whole spans had gone. You could hear the cries of the wounded. We tried everything we could to try and get across these spans, but couldn't do it. And of course, we couldn't get supplies through because the road had been bombed, or, you know, mined. And then little Ernie Elvin, or Billy Elvin, to give me his full title, William, he'd swum across the river with Phil Crofts. And that was a courageous thing to do because that river was near enough in full spate at the time. Of course, then the story came out. You know, what's happened, the boys were over there dying and God knows what. Over the other side of the bridge to the right, there's a house. They took over the house as a first aid post. Now, the woman that lived in there, I've got a picture, I've got a name, it's upstairs, Erica. Anyway, there was her and her daughter in there. She turned the whole house over as a first aid post. And Bob Allen, a mate of mine, he was one of the first to cross. He got away with it, but he was a brain gunner. But his brain gun barrel was bent by the force of the explosion because it was torn out of his hands. But the barrel was actually bent. And he said that this woman was a marvellous woman. He said, you couldn't fall. She might have been a German, but she looked after the boys. She tended them. One of them died in her arms, calling out for his mum. And she was saying, he said, I heard her say, I am your mother. And he died in her arms. Every sheet that was in the house, anything they could tear up for bandages and so forth, she gave it up. And that's why she still got that letter that was written by Major Reed, commending this woman for the courageous work she'd done and asking the authorities to replace all the sheets, the bedding and stuff that she destroyed in helping us. And she's still alive today, and we met her 4 years ago. And it turned out eventually 28 boys died in that, plus those that was killed at the airfield. They were buried on the green. And from there, they were transferred to the main British cemetery at Salter, S-O-L-T-E-U. That's about, it's about 4 or 5 miles, and just outside Hanover. Then after that, it was just a question of galloping on and on and on. One thing I've got to say, that when we buried our boys the next day with a full military funeral, who's coming through? The Highland Light Infantry. And I've got to say this to those men. Those that could stand in their lorry all stood up and saluted. And to us, that was a marvellous gesture. I'll never forget. And as I say, we carried on little minor skirmishes here, and at the other one, if you can call it a skirmish, we got fired on from some woods. And it turned out the woods, there were 17 of these Hitler youths. Only young lads, but it just shows you how their minds had been warped. Because they wouldn't give in. They died to a man. And I think the youngest looked about 12, to be honest with you. The oldest looked about 16, 17. You know, when you think this is what war has done to mankind, it's awful. It really is.
This was near Hanover, was it?
No, this was that between Celle and Wismar. Mecklenburg. Between Celle and Mecklenburg, just outside Mecklenburg. And then from then onwards, the last big major do for us was Wismar, but that was a bit of a cakewalk, really, the whole brigade. The whole brigade marched into that place, and it was more or less a walkover. And we carried on to a place called Kletzin, K-L-E-T-Z-I-N. That's about 40 miles from Lübeck, and that was it. The war finished. And within a couple of days, we came home.
Did you come into contact with the Russian troops?
Yes, sir.
What did you make of them?
Do you want me to tell you?
Please.
I thought they were the scruffiest lot of bastards the world's ever created. I do, really. They stank to high heaven. Their mannerism, how can you say, arrogant, aloof. They thought they were the cream. But they were the scruffiest lot of sods, ignorant sods I've ever met. And as our bloke said, well, if they are Russia's first line troops, we've got nothing to worry about.
In what way were they ignorant?
Oh, they thought they was it. That was it. You was nothing compared to them. But I've got to say this much, their officers, you know, they were a little bit better. In fact, they invited us to a meal. Now, I don't know if people in England realise what they eat out there, but it's little square or cubes of fish, but raw fish. And what with that and the vodka, can they knock that stuff back? And that was the only meal that we had with them, and then we, photographs were taken, etc. and so forth, and that was it.
How were they behaving towards the Germans?
Oh, without a doubt, the Germans were absolutely scared of them, without any doubt whatsoever. One incident, just before Mecklenburg it was, we come to a crossroad, about 9 o'clock at night, we got billeted in these few houses, it was on the crossroad. I put a guard out. And he come and woke me up. He said, "Sergeant, you better come out here." I said, "Well, what's the matter?" He said, "There's a couple of German officers out here." Anyway, I went out with him. This officer said, "You are an officer?" I said, "I'm a non-commissioned officer. I wish to meet an officer," he said. Well, I said, "First of all, you've met a non-commissioned officer, and I will take your message. You're not going in to see him. What you want?" "I wish to see an officer, and I will say nothing until I see the officer." I said, "Okay, fair enough." So I said, "This guard," all his mate had come up by then. I said, "Now guard them properly." They move, any force move, don't muck about, shoot. Anyway, I've got Jock Burns, it was, and Mr. Burns, who'd taken over by then. He come out. "What's the trouble?" "We want to see your commanding officers." "Now make your minds up." He said, "You see my sergeant, you wanted to see me, so now you want to see the commanding officer. You'll tell me what you want," he said, "because otherwise we would just take it as ordinary prisoners." And that's when he came out. He said, "I have some men up the road there," he said, "who are prepared to come down, bring their weapons, put them in the centre of that road or wherever we wish," he said, "and they would go on their own accord wherever you want them to go," he said. And he said, "If we don't, He said, then they're up there and we'll fight to the last Russian and we'll fight to the last bullet.
To the last Russian?
To the last Russian and to the last bullet. He said, we won't give in to them. They did. They literally lived in fear of their lives. Anyway, the CO was brought down and he gave the order, right, bring them through. They took about 9 hours coming through. I think, if I remember rightly, somebody said about 85,000 gave in. Never seen so many German troops in all your life. But, as I said before, they lived in fear of the Russians. There's no two ways about it. But I suppose if what I've read is true, they deserved it if the treatment they gave to the Germans is true with what I've read about, you see.
You were saying earlier that earlier on in the war, you did work as a warden. Whereabouts was that?
Down in Collingdale.
So, were you there in the Blitz?
Yeah. No, number of the post was G for George, 41. My father was a warden, my sister was a warden.
What did your work as a warden involve?
Well, the normal thing, you know, taking out. So if there was an air raid, like if bombs had fallen, go around, find out what the trouble was, any problems. If you wanted the heavy rescue or light rescue, if there was gas escaping, electricity, pipes or lines had been cut, etc. Telephone lines were down, making all those reports out, sort of style, you see.
Did Collindale get much bombing in the Blitz?
Yes, it's now the GPO place, but it used to be the Phoenix Telephone Works where I used to work. That cop one, the Frigidaire's, which is also a part now of the telephone place, that was bombed. One fell in front of, which is now Merritt House, big. That's also a telephone place. Well, offices, really. One fell in the road there, but that used to be the big trolley bus depot there. And one fell on the depot. One fell on the bridge in Collindale Avenue, but that fell in the soft mud there, so the flats beside it were saved. The other one fell on the British Museum paper place. Paper was flying all over the place. And one fell on the allotments that was just outside there. And then about a year previous to that, Collindale Station was hit by a parachute mine. That was a bad disaster there, boys. Now, two girls. Previous to that, I'd gone in a fish and chip shop just down the road with them. A chap called Charlie Robertson, he was our chief post warden to get fish and chips for the rest of the gang. And these two girls was in there and this police officer walked in and he said to these two girls, what are you doing out this time of the night? He said, with all this going on. Oh, they said, we just come for some fish and chips. All right then, girls, he said, hurry up and get them and go off home. He said, and get yourself, put away safely. The first two they pulled out of that station were these two girls. They disobeyed the policeman's orders and they'd gone in the station instead. And their house was untouched. It was only four doors away from the station.
So what was the date when the Collindale station was hit?
The date, I can't give you the actual date, but that would be around about 1942, between 41 and 42, that was it. But London Transport should know that anyway. That would be recorded with London Transport. Then you had bombs fall at Sunny Hill Fields, Hendon Aerodrome, a couple on the Marshalling Yards, which used to be Quickerwood, being the Marshalling Yard. And then there was one particular night, according to the Germans, none of their aircraft ever flew over Britain. That was Hendon, the only place that had a bomb fall on it. Flattened about five roads.
In Hendon?
In Hendon. Quite a number of people were killed there. There's a mass grave in the Millill Cemetery. Now, word went round that the top of ground there it's now one of the polytechnic schools, but it was the headquarters for the civil defence. And word went round that the message that went up to them was it was an unknown heavy enemy caliber bomb. But it was also about a week later, rumours flew very, very much. That it was one of our lads carrying one of these, the big blockbuster bombs, was in trouble. And he spotted the Welsh Harp and it's caught the edge of the well sharp. If it had gone in the ARP itself, it might have been a bit different, you see. Now, a chap, Bill Curry, was on park duty opposite the station where the shelters were, and he'd flung himself down, and he said as he flung himself down, he heard this plane coming over, and he could hear it was in difficulty, the noise it was making. He said, for some unknown reason, he flung himself, and as he turned around, he said he saw this sort of a purple flash, which they can only mean it was, must have been the bomb sort of dropping. But, as I say, the Germans maintained they did not have any aircraft whatsoever over the British Isles. So to this day, really, it's a mystery.
What was morale like in the Blitz?
Oh, it was amongst our group, I think. How can I put it without sounding... it was sort of jolly. There was no... nothing miserable, if you know what I mean. What's the point in being miserable? There's nothing you could do about it anyway, you see. But, oh no, the jollification was there, you know, the presence of the Germans over here, I mean, it was always felt, you know, people was aware of it. Where my father worked was called the Polar Bear Laundry, and they put a huge concrete shelter up. And the day war was declared, the piano from my house, or my mum and dad's house, was taken into that shelter. And it did not come out of that shelter until 2 days after the war finished. And that's where our sing songs and everything. The airmen from Endon Aerodrome used to come down, have sing songs with us, and it stayed there right the way throughout the war. And that was the scene, you know. It was one of those, how can I put it, whatever Jerry does, he won't beat us. I don't think he would have ever pulled us to our feet in that respect. And we got called out, we had a pretty calm over here, we got called out to Surrey Docks. Assistance, quite a few of us around here, was taken up by lorries. The place me and my dad and Charlie Robinson were there was the Tate and Lyle Sugar warehouse. That burnt for a fortnight. And we thought we'd seen bomb damage here, but God, it was ghastly when you saw it up there. But the mood of the people, their spirit was still there. There was nothing sort of miserable about them. You know, they had that look, he's not going to get us. As simple as that.
What exactly were you doing at the Tate and Lyle warehouse?
Well, it was just a question of patrolling with the rest, see if there was anything you could do to help them. You did it. If there was any messages to take out to the police, to the ambulance, to the firemen or whatever, you was there just to help them take those messages out, you see. I mean, in my own mind, when I got there with my father and the other post warden and I saw the state, I thought, what the hell, they called us here, what can we do? You look, the building's burning. I mean, I'm not a fireman, I can't put it out. But it was just a question, apart from taking a message, going around the street shelters there was to make sure everybody was okay.
What was the attitude towards the Germans who were doing the bombing? Did people hate them?
Well, yeah, it was there. Whether it was there just momentarily or whether it stayed for a while, I don't really know. It's, I suppose it was the same with the Germans when our boys dropped our bombs over there. You know, you had a sort of a hatred to them, but again, when you look at it, and let's be realistic about it, they were only doing a job. The same as our chaps were doing the job, wasn't they, you see? Hatred was there, there's no two ways about it, but I suppose that was just to get the feedback.